I think the most disheartening thing, and ironic, given that his stated goal is to make America great again, is that the sum total of this will be making America more of a normal country, meaning we're less unique.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in New York today, and I'm pleased to welcome to the table three of our newest contributors who will be leading the charge for FP's shadow government blog, Julie Smith, Derek Chollet, and Colin Call. Julie is a senior fellow and director of strategy and statecraft program at the Center for New American Security. She's also an advisor at Beacon Global Strategies, LLC, and was previously the deputy national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. Derek is executive vice president and senior advisor for security and defense policy at the German Marshall Fund. He's the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and is also the author of The Long Game, How Obama Defied Washington and Redefined America's Role in the World. And Colin is currently a professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service in the Security Studies program. Previously, he was deputy assistant to President Barack Obama and national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. ER nerds, I know you're all anxious to get your hands on one of our coveted ER mugs. Keep sending us your ideas or your pathetic stories of why you need a mug, and perhaps you'll get one. Sometimes you break our hearts with the pleas to have a kind of vessel that you can put your paper clips in. You can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Recently, from our tiny podcast studio, high above Washington's DuPont Circle, and from Brooklyn, we had the following conversation. So, Derek, you wrote a book about how Barack Obama redefined America's role in the world. We're just over a week into the administration of Donald Trump. He doing the same thing?
Well, first, David, thanks for having us. And I can say that, speaking for myself, I'm really pleased to be part of this shadow government, and I'm really thrilled to be with Foreign Policy. So far, I think it's been one of the more dramatic weeks in American foreign policy. And although there's still a lot of unknowns, and from personnel to how some of Donald Trump's tweets are going to get implemented, it seems to be a pretty dramatic shift. It's one that I think, unfortunately, many of us were expecting.
So, you know, I actually just had a column that looks at all the shifts. And I think it's arguably the case that in the course of week one, or the transition plus week one, we've seen more major shifts in U.S. foreign policy than we have at any time in recent history, whether it's moving away from the one China policy, embracing Russia, moving away from our traditional commitment to free trade, moving away from our traditional commitment to NATO, to multilateralism, to the United Nations, even, you know, picking a fight with our friendly next-door neighbor, Mexico. Area by area by area, you see U.S. foreign policy going in directions that it has seldom gone in the past. And even when it's gone in one or two of the directions, it hasn't gone in all those directions. Julie, what's worrying you the most right now?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having us on. And we're all really looking forward to ramping up shadow government on the FP site. It's hard to pick one thing that worries me the most. I would say what worries me right now, I guess, is probably influenced by the number of meetings that I'm having with our allies from around the world. Many of us are constantly getting requests to sit down with friends from Europe, from Asia, from the Middle East, and there's a tremendous amount of anxiety, not just from a policy perspective, but how the government is going to function on a day-to-day basis, how they can make inroads in developing new relationships with the cast of characters that are arriving on the scene, and the fundamental shift in just the pillars of U.S. foreign policy. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, there's just some things that have always stayed the same. And one of them, just to cite one example, is that NATO matters. It's imperfect, it's rusty, it's creaky, it drives us nuts sometimes, but it's absolutely indispensable. And to have a president that's tweeting out that an institution like that is obsolete is obviously sending shivers down the spines of our European allies. And that experience, not just on NATO, but on countless other issues, is something that you hear from our allies and partners around the world. I met yesterday with a group of Japanese folks. They had similar concerns and anxieties. And the last thing I'll say is I think the thing that's troubling them the most is trying to figure out who's right. So on a Monday, they might hear something from, say, General Mattis or Secretary Mattis over at the Pentagon. On a Tuesday, they might read a tweet from Donald Trump. Wednesday, they might have a phone call with Flynn over at the White House, and they're not lining up in terms of the messaging and the fundamental shape of U.S. foreign policy. And so the big question out there, not only for Americans, but for our partners around the world, is who's going to prevail?
Well, you know, Colin, our audience is nerds, basically. They're ER nerds. There's a lot of ER nerds, by the way. I'm surprised by how many, frankly. We started out with 11. That's all thought, you know, that's what we thought we'd get maximum. We're sort of heading up to 70,000 subscribers right now. And we just passed, by the way, our millionth download of this podcast. So the ER nerds are out there and they're listening and they love really nitty gritty stuff that you don't get on the major networks. And what Julie's talking about strikes me as something that you'll recognize as a complete absence of a policy process. In other words, you know, Trump wakes up in the morning, he sees something from the Mexican president, and he tweets out something saying, go jump in a lake. And then everybody sort of scrambles around to keep up with it. Or he says to Mattis a few weeks ago, No, I hear you. No more torture. And then, like, you know, changes his mind and doesn't tell Mattis. He doesn't tell Pompeo. He doesn't brief his team. You've been inside the policy process. You've also sort of seen the transition to this policy process. Is it really as bad as it seems to me, as I'm describing it?
It pretty much looks that way. Obviously, I'm not in the White House anymore. But during the transition, it was a couple of things became clear. These guys didn't think they were going to win, so they weren't ready to govern. It took them a long time to get their teams into the various agencies. Had Clinton won, the landing team, so to speak, the folks who would come over to the agencies would have been there within probably 24 or 48 hours. It took, weeks to get them in. At the NSC alone, they had three different landing teams over the course of 70 days. I didn't meet with my successor, the new incoming National Security Advisor to Vice President Pence, until 26 hours before the inauguration. They were discombobulated during the transition. And they're understaffed. We don't know who the deputy secretaries, the assistant secretaries, the undersecretaries, the deputy assistant secretaries. And it's also completely unclear how the process will be organized. And then, of course, you have the wild card of the commander-in-chief himself, who is extraordinarily impulsive, who goes off in a million different directions prompted by something that he read or something that he saw on the shows. And it's completely unclear how this process is going to work out. And I think that the nerds listening to ER should pay attention to basically three different areas. One is the formal process. How does Mike Flynn, the new National Security Advisor, actually run the interagency process? Two is the informal process. The commander-in-chief's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is likely to have a prominent role, at least on some Middle East issue. So what does it mean to have a formal process that's led by Flynn and an informal process that involves the folks who are down the hall from the Oval Office? And then the third thing to look out for is, do the cabinet secretaries matter? You could see one model in which Trump is kind of the star of the show, and he kind of just lets people like Mattis or Pompeo or Tillerson run with it. I mean, even on some of the comments that you saw last week about whether he was going to go back to torture or black sites or other things, he seems to be doing, you know, deference to his cabinet secretaries. Will he actually let them govern and he just is the star of the show? Or are you actually going to have a very White House-centric policy, which has been the norm, frankly, in the last two administrations, but there's nothing normal about the new gang?
Well, okay, we may want to come back to a couple of those points because they're just the kind of juicy things that these listeners of ours like to get to. But Derek, I want to talk about one other dimension of this process that has been sort of front and center recently, and that is the bureaucracy itself. And I can give you two examples that we may want to think about, right? There was a story about the core management team at the State Department leaving. Now, there's some dispute, at least at the time that we're recording this, of whether they quit or were fired, but that's a 60,000 per person bureaucracy. The people who quit were career people, or the people who left were career people. And it really sort of takes away something vital from how the system works. I'll give you another story before you react to this, and that is I was talking to a very, very prominent reporter the other day, and he was saying that his phone lit up one night, and he came back, and he thought there'd been some kind of an attack or something. There were so many messages on it. And then he looked down, and it was all people, career military people, career foreign service people, career intel people, leaking various draft executive orders. In other words, they didn't like them, and they thought, well, why don't I send them to this big media organization as a way of helping to shape the process because I don't know else how to do it. The bureaucracy matters, too, and they don't seem to have really been connected to by the Trump team. Is that correct?
I think that's absolutely right, David. Last week, when some of these stories popped that you referred to, whether it was on the torture memo or rendition or black sites— or even on immigration, on any given day, it seemed there were two or three news stories about different drafts of these executive orders floating around that were clearly leaked from the inside. And I think the drama that we all saw play out during the transition, where Trump got into a fight with the intelligence community, I expect that to evolve in a way where it's not just going to be the intelligence community, it's going to be the Foreign Service, it's going to be the uniform military, it's going to be the career bureaucracy that will fight back. And this gets back to a question actually that Colin and Julie both talked about, which was sort of what we expect out of this process. And it does seem to me that we have a potential here where, and this sort of sounds odd to say given what's been happening in the last few days, but that over time, if there's no connectivity between what Trump says and what actually happens, right? If he says we're going to make Mexico pay for the wall and they don't, or if he says we're going to punish our NATO allies for not paying their fair share and there isn't really any appreciable change in U.S. policy to Europe, allies and those of us who are watching closely will start to see that there's no there, and that if the White House doesn't assert control over the process, it's not going to exercise any control. I mean, we all know from being part of the bureaucracy, you included, David, that the natural tendency of agencies, whether you're the Pentagon or the State Department, is to basically do your own thing. I mean, within broad policy parameters that are set by the president, but we've become so accustomed over the last couple decades of a process that's White House-centered, that is tightly controlled by the White House, where there's a steady stream of meetings to assure there's accountability and to call cabinet secretaries and their underlings on the carpet to ensure that they're doing what the president wants. Well, if either because of incompetence or lack of interest, that's not going to happen out of the Trump White House, and I think it is too soon to tell whether that will actually happen, we could see a situation where the agencies, particularly an agency like the Pentagon, more or less does what it wants. And that, for some people, that could be quite reassuring. In other words, we could see a lot more continuity than some may expect. In other instances, and we've seen in recent history, particularly, say, under the Rumsfeld era, where that kind of agency independence was something that concerned a lot of people. So that's what I'll be looking for very closely. And by the way, just one thing to add on this, say, from the Pentagon perspective, I think right now you're seeing in, for example, John McCain, who's the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, I think he'd be perfectly fine if he and Jim Mattis essentially ran U.S. defense policy, pretending as though the White House doesn't exist.
Well, you know, I think there are a number of other analogies we could look at here. As you know, I've written a couple of histories of the NSC and the foreign policy process, and the only era that even seems remotely close to this is the early days of the Reagan administration, when he reordered the structure at the top of the White House. He tried to downgrade the NSC with Richard Allen and then later Judge Clark. People within that system then went off like Ollie North and did their own thing, and that led to some problems. But Julie, there's a flip side to what Derek's talking about. You know, one of the critiques that might have been offered about the Obama administration was, It was very White House-centric, and the White House kept a lot of control and micromanaged and didn't give the agencies as much leash as they might have wanted. And that's one kind of way to be White House-centric. Another way to be White House-centric is if the White House does whatever it wants, doesn't consult with the agencies, surprises the agencies constantly by what it's doing, and expects them to be kind of like the guys at the end of the parade with a broom, sort of cleaning up the mess that they make as they go along. And it seems like we're headed more in that direction than the other direction. And I'm just wondering, is that a trend you're also seeing? Is the disconnect between the White House and the agencies worrisome to you?
Well, it is, but I think Derek's right. It's too early to really know how this is ultimately going to play out. But I think there are a couple models here. There's like the inside game in terms of the White House is trying to control, like, who chairs an interagency meeting, who gets the final vote, who decides how many seats are around the table. You know, the management day-to-day grind of managing policy and the implementation of policy and policy formulation is one thing, and that was a process in the Obama administration that happened for lots of reasons, where the White House wanted to pull in a little bit, right? So now the question is, if we go the opposite direction, I think there's also the outside, like, what are you presenting to the outside world? Like, in the Obama administration, we might have been arguing amongst ourselves about who's in control of the final word on this policy, or again, who's chairing the meeting, or who's in the meeting, and all of that. But we tried to ensure, I think, that we had a coherent message and policy, right? And that's part of the reason I think the White House wanted to pull in a little bit, to ensure that we could have that, because it's so important to speak with one voice, however difficult that might be. In this case, there's a difference between empowering the interagency and saying, state and DOD, we're going to give you a little bit more leeway in the policy formulation end of it. But it's entirely different if you say, we're going to continually each and every morning have inconsistent messaging and contradictory messaging coming out of, say, state DOD and the White House. And so they're going to have to figure out not only how to manage the day-to-day operations, but how are you messaging the outside world? And our allies will not like the uncertainty associated with hearing one thing from one agency and another thing from another agency. I mean, irrespective of who's in the Oval Office, you always hear some complaints about that. It's a big government, lots of larger-than-life personalities, and we've seen it for every single president. But I think what we're about to see with this administration is the extreme example of that, where, again, you've got a president that's tweeting anytime, day or night, directly in contradiction with what you're hearing from his cabinet secretaries.
Okay, well, look, you know, we could sit here and we can guess at what's going to happen next, or we can be critical of what's happened on an early basis. But one of the things that you guys have done in taking over shadow government that I think was very constructive is you started by going to the team of folks that you've got who are going to contribute to this really, really important section of FP, where we essentially give the loyal opposition a chance to chime in on foreign policy. And you went out to your team and you sort of said, what's the advice you've got for the president? And you came up with a bunch of bits and pieces of answers. And of course, people can go and read that at foreignpolicy.com. But Colin, what did you take away from that? What are the 3, 4, 5 big bits of advice that you think are most important and also that are most likely to actually be followed? You know, I mean, you know, you could say, I think Donald Trump should change his hair and stop tweeting, and that's not going to happen. So let's stick to the ones that are possible.
Yeah, it's a good point. Look, I think the whole purpose of this site is we want them to succeed because we want our country to succeed. At least we want our country to be safe and prosperous. We don't want the administration to fail so catastrophically that it impacts our security and our way of life. And we also want to try, I think, through the site to strike a tone that is sufficiently constructive that the people who are willing to listen to anybody on the outside will listen, or, you know, at least read it or think about some of the ideas, so that we don't seem like we're just a bunch of partisan hacks that are going after them reflexively because we're not in power. So I think that's the tone we'll try to set. We'll see. It's
You guys are not partisan hacks. If you feel that way, get over it. Julie is doing therapy for visiting foreign leaders. Maybe she can do therapy for you. Exactly. You guys, that's, you know, the reason we've turned to you is because you're the opposite of
that. That's right. But I think part of that is we do have to convey that through the tone of the writing as much as possible. And I think that's why we're comfortable with the label of the loyal opposition. Look, I think that some of the initial suggestions, they kind of fall into two categories. I think first is they got to get their process right. And we've already talked a lot about that today. They got to figure out how they're going to run the interagency process, what role the White House is going to play in that. And I want to piggyback on something that Julie said here because it's super important. You know, the Obama administration, correctly or incorrectly, basically tried to set a clear message and tone to its interagency and then enforce it through the National Security Council. So when people talk about micromanaging, that's what they criticize. But it's also in an age of kind of 24/7 events where things are moving at the speed of Twitter, there's a lot of pressure on the White House to be responsive in real time because they're going to get the blame whenever something goes wrong. So it's kind of clear message from the top and then drive it through the interagency. Another model, which I think some of the Clinton folks were thinking about, is to have more of a commander's intent and then delegate to your agencies to run it. But that depends on there being a high degree of compatibility
between
the policy and ideological orientation of the White House and the senior officials throughout the bureaucracy so that you can kind of trust your commanders in the field, so to speak, to go out and execute your commander's intent. And then a third model is you could have a lot of uncertainty and inconsistency from the White House that seems impulsive and erratic, and you could have cabinet members who fundamentally disagree with what the White House is doing, and that's a recipe for chaos. And in the early days of the Trump administration, that's the model that appears to be taking shape. And if they don't fix that, then the government will be paralyzed, which is, I guess, if you're fearful of what Trump will do, that might be a good thing until there's a crisis, and there will be a crisis, in which case the government won't be sufficiently nimble to respond. So number one is the process. The second thing is there are going to be some big early decisions that they're going to have to make and some big early issues they're going to have to address. And I would just highlight two very briefly. One is they're really going to have to figure out some of the fundamental choices they make on the counter ISIL campaign, the campaign against the Islamic State, especially as it relates to the play they may or may not try to run with the Russians, how that interacts with what they may or may not do vis-a-vis the Iranians, the Turks, and others. And there are some decisions that will come to them within days and weeks about what to do against the Islamic State, especially in Syria, that will really put to the test a lot of what the new president has talked about thus far. And the second big issue is how do you try to calm our allies down? Because as Julie mentioned, and well, as everybody is aware—
Isn't Julie doing that
therapy
herself?
Sessions?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, but
trying single-handedly.
But, you know, yeah. I mean, Derek suggested in his post, for example, just before Mattis actually announced it. I'm not sure correlation is causality here. But that Mattis needed to get on the road to Asia to settle some folks down. And I think that's cognizant of the fact that you have an administration that's going to pick a fight with China early, especially in the economic domain. You have allies who are nervous, Japan, the South Koreans, and you have the North Koreans on the verge of field testing an intercontinental ballistic missile for the first time. And all of these things could come together in a swirl and a spiral unless, you know, we and our allies are on the same side. So it's good that Jim Mattis is going downrange as soon as possible. But that's the type of thing that they're going to have to think about.
Well, isn't it, you know, I mean, you're talking in sort of traditional standards and traditional processes. But a big X factor would be whether having a functioning process or strong cabinet secretaries would actually have any influence at all on the behavior of the president. And if you have a process and you have strong cabinet secretaries, but nonetheless, when the president wakes up and he sees something by the president of Mexico, he says, well, I'm going to tweet out something about how he can go jump in a lake. You know, he could do the same thing about the Chinese, or he could take it personally and ignore people's advice. Having a detached president from the process is very dangerous. And there's almost no precedent from that where that president sought to impose their will. There were some dark moments with Nixon, perhaps, but there's almost no precedent for that. You worried about that, Derek?
I am, although I think the jury's still out about whether Trump we'll do that. I mean, I was just thinking in terms of precedents, it could be we see him turn into a Berlusconi, right? Someone who has a high profile but isn't necessarily involved in the mechanics of government. It could look like a more combustible version of late Reagan, someone who's largely checked out of the processes of government. And that's why I'm going to watch closely what kind of running room someone like Secretary Mattis has. That's why I suggested Mattis get out on the road. I don't think that there's there's a lot of hope we should have that there's going to be some sort of meeting of the minds between Mattis and Trump, honestly. But to the extent that Trump's going to let Mattis sort of do his thing, which so far everything that he said suggests that he will. I mean, whether it was the fact that Mattis contradicted him pretty much across the board in his confirmation hearings to last week, Trump's comments on torture. That's why it's kind of the spirit of this site and trying to be constructive critics. Some of the stuff we can work with is people like General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. Now, there's a lot of unknowns. We don't know who. They haven't named a single other policy official within the Department of Defense as of this recording. So there's still a lot of shoes to drop here. But it seems to me that particularly if there are those in the cabinet who are playing within the broad consensus of the national security community, even though there will have honest policy differences, you know, folks who believe in strong alliances, believe in NATO, believe in a strong military, but embedded within a larger context of American power, diplomacy, development, et cetera, we will seek to work with those folks, understanding that they may never prevail in convincing Trump that he's wrong, but it may be that Trump becomes less and less relevant.
All right. I'm going to ask one more serious question, and then I'm going to move on to sort of the lightning round, where I'm going to throw out a bunch of things that have happened in the world recently, and I'm going to ask you to set aside your thoughtfulness and just respond in a more impulsive and superficial way, because, you know, that's what our listeners really want. But Julie, as these people are coming in and you're talking to people from other countries, what advice are you giving our allies about how to deal with this government?
The main piece of advice is throw out your old playbook. I'm hearing from a lot of allies, well, if we could just get some time with the president to explain X. So maybe we should have another conversation about TPP. Maybe we should come in and talk to him about the rules-based order and the value of the international system. And that's when you have to say, hold up, the game is over. We're not going to use that type of language. This is a transactional type of relationship. You can talk about the value of your bilateral relationship or the institutions of which you are a member, but don't romanticize it. Don't describe everything in terms of values, but concrete deliverables. So Denmark, you know, talk about what you're doing in the counter-ISIL coalition. And if you're Jordan, you know, you talk about your contributions to safety and security across the region. Don't frame it in the old way. We're used to talking about this alphabet soup of international organizations and how they matter more than ever before. And I think none of that, you know, we're not going to come in and defend the status quo and succeed with this administration. And so allies are going to have to frame things in two ways. First, they can talk about the bilateral relationship and the organizations in which we both are a member. But secondly, they've got to come in with fresh ideas, fresh thinking, innovative policy proposals, something new and different. So to go back to the NATO example, talk about all that NATO's done since the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it's a pretty long list, but spend about 2 minutes on that and then get to business on what NATO's going to be doing going forward. And just don't try to come back to kind of the old lexicon of, you know, what all our listeners here at the ER podcast love, and all of us make a living by talking about all of these terms and writing about them. But this is a brave new world in terms of the way in which we're going to engage this presidency, particularly Trump. Now, it'll be different with Mattis. Mattis gets it. He speaks the language. But for some of these others, particularly as people come into lower level positions, maybe from the business world or the business private sector, and they don't have exposure and they don't care to sit around and talk about the liberal world order for 2 hours. It's going to have to be more fast moving and agile, and it's just going to be a different type of dialogue. It doesn't mean it's all going to come crashing down. I hope it doesn't. But to have an impact on that and to avoid that from happening, we have to reframe the debate and get more creative about the ways in which we're talking about this with Trump himself.
Okay, so that's very thoughtful. And I'm not saying don't be thoughtful in this next part of the show, but I would like sort of capsule responses, you know, like the president of the United States would make. So let me just throw out some terms and then you guys can respond. And I'm not going to direct them, you know, just chime in and step on each other. Here's two words I'd love a reaction to. Tulsi Gabbard. Go. Thank you. You guys are getting the hang of this.
Yeah. I think her policy in Syria is pretty much Trump's policy in Syria.
Seems that way.
Which is crazy-ass policy.
To lean into the Russians and Assad.
Line up with
the
regime. Yeah, grand
bargain. What's going on? This is like a Democrat from Hawaii who's like a Bernie supporter who decides to go and play footsie with Assad. And she like comes back and is like, that's the legitimate government. And, you know, why shouldn't we want to team up with the Russians as they attack terrorists? Except they're not actually attacking terrorists. So, and she should know that. She served in the region. What's up? Is the woman cracked?
I have no idea. I mean, there are those on the far left who, you know, there's the ideological horseshoe, where those on the far right and the far left actually end up in the same place. But I don't think she represents mainstream progressive thinking, I would say, on Syria or Russia. But
I do think there's a strand of thinking in both the right and the left that are against regime change. And that believe that basically we can't fix or shouldn't try to fix the Middle East, and therefore all we should do is fight terrorists. And therefore anybody who,
allegedly
wants to fight terrorists, to include the most odious of regimes and the most odious of partners, therefore should be our partners. And there's a certain logic to that. It just, in this case, won't work.
Yeah. Well, there is that, right? All right. How about the president of Mexico's trip to the United States?
Fraught.
Gone.
Not happening.
Not happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sad.
So sad.
Sad.
Apologize. Exclamation point.
I mean, what's going on here? I mean, first of all, why pick a fight with your next door neighbor? Secondly, why, you know, push the point of them paying for it when you've already gone down that road and it hasn't worked out so well? Thirdly, why get into a Twitter war with them, you know, from your bed or wherever he was tweeting from the morning that the Mexicans finally decided to turn around? Is this a prelude of things to come?
I actually think it betrays a fundamental misunderstanding of how the world works in general. I mean, even on Trump's own terms, where you care about migration, you care about drugs, you care about the safety of the border, you cannot do that unless Mexico is a partner and Mexico's economy is thriving. And yet you have a president who wants to destroy the diplomatic partnership, which means they won't work with us to stop migration from Central America, for example, which is the big flood of migrants, not from Mexico. In fact, we send more people back to Mexico every year these days than come from Mexico itself. And they also want to – he wants to apparently immiserate Mexico's economy by renegotiating NAFTA or tearing it up in a way that would harm the Mexican economy, which of course it was the improvement of the Mexican economy, which is the whole reason Mexico doesn't send as many migrants here as possible. So he wants to spend billions of dollars on a wall that will do nothing and destroy the relationship that is actually essential to solving the problem that he's put on the table. But other than that, it's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think, David, the shorter version of what Collins just said is Donald Trump's going to learn the hard way you cannot treat other countries like Atlantic City contractors.
And also, I mean, it's sorry to nerd out, forgive me, but I mean, it shows these exchanges show a total lack of understanding of nuance. I mean, everyone's good, bad. So now he's decided Mexico bad, right? But this is the problem I think Colin was alluding to earlier. You know, you can't simultaneously, for example, label China bad, 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 evildoer, ripping us off, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But then when we get into trouble with the North Koreans, which will probably happen in the not too distant future, who are you going to call, right, to work? So I think he can't wrap his head around on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, maybe you do have tensions and challenges and friction in some bilateral relationship around the world, but on Tuesday and Thursday, you might want to put those aside because you got bigger fish to fry. And that's what you can see. He can't master that. He cannot appreciate the complexities of these relationships. Countries don't fit into good and evil. A lot of them, breaking news, are a little bit of both, depending on the issue and the day. And so I think in this case, he's going to learn fast that coming after some of these world leaders, making it incredibly personal and making these quick judgments really early is going to hurt him and leave him with nobody to call when the next crisis, you know, breaks.
I have to say that really threw into my mind a whole plethora of literary historical references, from Freud's assertion that maturity was defined as the ability to forego, you know, immediate satisfaction in favor of some greater future return, to Fitzgerald's assertion that, you know, the hallmark of a good quality mind is the ability to hold two ideas that are in contradiction to each other in it at the same time. But where I was left with was the Orwell reference that hasn't been made as often as 1984 in these discussions, and that's Animal Farm, in which they say, you know, four legs good, two legs bad, you know, and it's really simplistic and foolish. But let's move away from that.
From Animal
Pretty,
Farm.
Pretty deep there, David.
This is, I thought like, this very, was the
well,
fun round.
Yeah, this is the fun. That's fun for nerds.
Wow.
You guys are not nerdy enough. But, okay, so let's talk a little bit about one of the Obama administration's alleged favorites. We could debate that, but TPP.
Well, the irony about TPP is that, you know, the two big threats that the Trump team has identified as their signature issues are the threat from quote-unquote radical Islam and the economic threat posed by China. And in fact, the radical Islam threat is the wolf closest to the shed, but the medium and long-term challenge is the quote-unquote economic war with China that will define the rest of the 21st century. Well, if the goal is to best China, either economically or geopolitically, there is no greater gift that you could give them than to walk away from TPP and cede the entire economic battlefield in Asia and the geopolitical one to the Chinese. So that's an own goal of major proportions early in the administration.
But at the same time, I mean, I think this, and this is where the kind of nerdy process stuff really does matter. Clinton would have walked away from TPP, right? I mean, I think, but she would have probably done it in less of a falling off the cliff kind of way. I'm going to sign the executive order, and then we have no idea what's coming next. It would have been more of a smooth transition to something different.
Something else, yeah.
But she had not left herself a lot of room to wiggle out of a commitment to pull out of TPP either.
I think in the interest of fairness, neither had her husband on NAFTA. But what he did was he came in and he said, I want to go and reopen this. And he fixed a couple of things. And then it became his NAFTA and he embraced it. And she could have done the same.
And there might have been a shot to pass it in the lame duck if she had won. That's the other. That's
yeah,
the, she, that's
I
the other
think
thing.
That's
yeah.
probably that would have been the play to get it in the lame duck.
Yeah.
There's also something in this TPP thing, which I just want to throw out there for you, which is the notion that somehow it's better to do bilateral trade deals than multilateral trade deals. Do any of you have any view on that?
I just think the jury's out.
Yeah,
And the other thing, too, is that not to get too nerdy for your nerds, but the transaction costs of negotiating
huge.
12 separate bilateral trade agreements with the countries as opposed to taking the agreement that's on the shelf currently. I mean, we'll be in this for years. I mean, ask most of the folks in the UK whether they're looking forward to having to renegotiate everything about the common market bilaterally with, you know, or dealing
27
with
27 others.
It's,
right.
It's a nightmare.
Right.
Okay, well, that's the correct answer, by the way. And as a former trade official, I can tell you there's another cost associated with it, and that is you go, you negotiate a lot of bilateral deals, and then corporations come to you and say, I have to deal with 15 different standards mm-hmm.
yep.
in the region.
Exactly.
Yep.
And then you start a negotiation on standards harmonization, and then you end up moving towards a multilateral deal because that's what makes economic sense as a marketplace.
Yeah.
Israel, Palestine,
Embassy.
U.S. Embassy. Yeah.
Look, I mean,
Julie.
Go ahead.
I mean, it's an unforced error. I mean, if they decide to lead with this, the Israeli-Palestinian situation is hard enough, and the situation in the Middle East is fraught enough. This adds an element that to be honest, the Israelis are not really even pushing for. And to do it purely for our own political reasons or to satisfy one of the fringes in Israeli politics seems to me to just create more problems than it's worth, particularly at a moment where one of the dirty secrets of the changing geopolitics of the Middle East is how there's greater strategic confluence right now between the Israeli and many of its Sunni neighbors than either side really likes to talk about. And throwing this issue right into the middle of this would actually undermine a lot of the progress that's been quietly made in that space for the last couple of years.
I think it'll be an early test to see whether they'll actually walk back on something, because there have been some suggestions, well, we're not going to do
stages,
it, so, you know, early stages of thinking about it, which sounds like something, a can they're going to kick down the road. That would be good news, because Derek's absolutely right. If we move our embassy to Jerusalem, there will be a third intifada. And it'll create so many geopolitical headaches for Israel at a moment where, you know, the fact that they could make common cause with not only the Trump administration, but the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Emiratis, the Saudis, et cetera, against a set of enemies that include the Islamic State, the Muslim Brotherhood, Iran. There is, you know, for better or worse, there's a real opportunity here that would be completely wasted if you do another own goal in this case.
But Julie, there's a bigger question lurking under this. Why didn't past presidents like President Obama have the wisdom to turn over really complicated diplomatic issues to their in-laws?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm speechless on that.
Yeah. But it's, you know, I mean, here's this guy who's like inherited some money and has no experience in this area. And, you know, they say, well, he's better than, you know, his father-in-law, which is setting the bar pretty low. And then they say, well, go take this incredibly difficult, intractable problem where you have identified yourself on the extreme right of the issue. You're already seen as being in the bag for the Israeli right wing, and you go solve that problem. Isn't that like a certain formula for failure?
Of course it is. Yeah. I mean, it's insanity. Sorry. It just is. And you're not going to put somebody in and have them act as an honest broker when you know their opening position is so extreme. I mean, and the family link and the whole thing. I mean, the conflicts here, the conflicts of interest, I mean, allies walking into meetings, not sure who's going to be sitting at the table. Is Ivanka there? Is another member of the family present? How much are they going to be coming and going? I mean, it's just a fundamental open-ended questions about every role. I mean, for Bannon, what is the role of Bannon? You know, is he really another national security advisor? Does he see himself as such? What do this cast of characters, what kind of roles do they anticipate playing, and what does it do to the career civil servants that are staffing the NSC right now? It's really, I mean, on this front, it's really disheartening.
And it feels a lot more like the palace intrigue that one would associate with, you know, what's going on in Turkey.
Well, that's
or Egypt, or, you know, frankly, where you don't have the types of institutions and processes that actually make our government more functional on any given day than those countries.
That's, I mean, I think the most disheartening thing, and ironic, given that his stated goal is to make America great again, is that the sum total of this will be making America more of a normal country, meaning we're less unique. We have the dysfunction that see throughout a lot of parts of the world where the government, for a variety of reasons, is incapable of functioning well.
So, you know, I'm getting you guys to let your hair down a little bit here. I feel really good about that. We've got 5 minutes or so left, but at least Julie used the word insanity for the first time here. And, you know, it's taken you a while to like come to grips with the reality that this is insane. What's going on here is insane. There is no process. The president himself is a loose cannon. There is no government in place. We're reversing major policies, the one China policy, our position with regard to Russia, our position with regard to NATO, our position with regard to the EU, our position with regard to the UN, our position with regard to, I don't know, freedom of religion, freedom of press, and a few other fundamentals, without any consultation early on in this going. We're waging a war against facts and against science, climate change is a foreign policy issue. In many respects, we don't seem to even allow U.S. government agencies to report scientific data about it publicly. Come on, admit it. This is nuts. There's never been anything like this that has happened in American history.
I think the technical term is it's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, actually.
Exactly.
No, it's supremely odd. And I remember President Obama was kind enough to invite a number of folks, senior staff folks, up to the residence the night before the inauguration. And we were kind of standing out on the Truman balcony overlooking the Washington Monument. And it felt a little bit like we were watching the last days of the Republic. It feels like that. I think the one thing, though, and this is, I suspect, something that Derek and Julie and certainly something I have as we've talked to our allies who are extraordinarily anxious across the world. And I remember doing this with Vice President Biden down the home stretch because, you know, when we would travel abroad during the lame duck period is let's see what the new administration does as opposed to all the noise. And frankly, a lot of the stuff that they've done last week is in the form of executive orders that were not coordinated with the rest of the executive branch that may be unenforceable, that basically put down markers about starting to do things or planning to do things. A lot of the other things that you mentioned have not actually been set in motion yet. There've just been a lot of body language in that way. And there's going to be a lot of resistance from what's left of the bureaucracy and from members of Trump's cabinet. And we, you know, sorry to keep coming back to process, but this is why this will really be a test of whether the bureaucracies, the institutions, and the individuals who disagree with Trump, A, will have the fortitude to push back, and B, whether the process will be such, either because they're delegated with authority or because the process allows for the president actually to change his mind, that they can at least rub off the hard edges of the worst thing that he's doing. But yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And if it doesn't get fixed, then we're all in a lot of trouble.
Well, Julie went for insane. Colin went for cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Derek?
Come on, Derek.
You're always so moderate. You're always so circumspect. You're probably wearing a tie and a suit. I can't see
almost,
you, but I'm
almost.
Guessing.
Almost.
I decided to let my hair down and not wear a tie. But, you know, other than that.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for doing that.
I mean, look.
What's your descriptive term?
Look, it is. I know we're a family show. But it's colossally effed up,
no.
Right? I mean, there's just no other way around, right?
We're not a family show, Derek.
Just think
and
HBO.
Believe me, this show is F bombs all the time. So
you know, well, my mom may listen, so I want to be, you know, somewhat. Okay.
Has your mom never heard you say fuck?
You know, I try to keep it clean. You know what I mean? I try to be a role model for my children and nieces and nephews.
Okay. Right? Okay. My mother sits at home at night throwing shoes at the television going, that fucker is going to destroy us all.
Yeah. But, I mean, look, the chaos, this gets back to something we've all said, and this is, I'm not trying to punt on an answer, but the more chaos there is, the more uncertainty there is coming out of the White House, right? A lot of the agencies may just say, fuck this. Like, they're not going to do it. And if there's not an enforcement mechanism in place, and moreover, if you have allies in Congress, and you certainly see that on the Senate side, on the foreign policy, members of Congress who are not going to be with the administration on some of these big policy shifts that you've talked about, David, whether it's on Russia or China, then it may be that the agencies resist. I mean, you know, I think all of us have experiences working in the White House, which is, you know, presidents get surprised about how when they say something or decide something, oftentimes there's not the kind of follow-up you would expect. And that's even in an administration where basically everyone agrees on the big ideas. It seems to me in an administration where there seem to be fundamental disagreements at the highest levels between cabinet heads and the president, I foresee a process of that's going to be continue of just kind of chaos than a kind of hard top-down White House-driven process. I just don't see it.
But one thing he can do, David, one thing he can do is his words can really degrade
totally
the image of America
yes.
in the world.
Already, that's why I said we're going to become more
and that's, and that's what's it already is. Happening.
Yeah.
And this is what goes back to what
Week
Derek
one.
Said,
yeah.
is that, you know, people can take question with the word American exceptionalism, but at least the way that I think about it, and I think a lot of us talk about it, is what has made us exceptional since the founding of our republic is that we've always been bigger than just our size. Even when we were a small country, our values gave us more influence in the world. And as we grew into the world's, eventually the world's only truly global power, We're able to shape and shove the dynamics of the international system so much more because of who we are and what we stand for, and the fact that people, even when we make mistakes, understand that we've also been committed over time to perfect our union and make ourselves better. And the degradation of that concept because of the way that Trump talks, that he never talks about our values, that America First is framed in terms of our economic productivity at the expense of others, but never in terms of who we are as a people and our tolerance. The fact that he talks about addressing prejudice through total allegiance to the state, which is crazy fascist ways of talking about things, it will degrade who we are on the world stage. And by turning us into a really normal country, let's make that clear for your listeners. That means we will be corrupt, venal, and transactional. And that's not the America that, you know, I went to work for.
But it is the America where the price of membership at Mar-a-Lago, the winter White House, was doubled from $100,000 to $200,000 a year, where they're actually selling admission to get close to this president. And the money goes into the pocket of the president. That's kind of stunning, too. That has some effect. Well, look, I wish we could talk about that. Folks who are listening to ER, you watch how this show affects and ultimately corrodes the minds of its guests. You've seen it again here. These three perfectly respectable people have loosened up. And we ended up with insanity, cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs and craziness, and Derek's fucked up as the way to describe the colossal fuck up to this administration. Personally, the term I like is in the very general sort of zip code of Derek's clusterfuck. In fact, I'm thinking that maybe the title of my next book, Clusterfuck Inside the Trump National Security Process. But you know, it's early yet, and he could learn how to do foreign policy. His team could take hold. The grown-ups could take over. The folks who are screwing things up could step aside. The world could become a great place, and Kanye West could become the Archbishop of Canterbury, all of which are roughly sort of at the same level. If you want really smart analysis of what's going on in this administration from the group of people who most recently had experience making policy and implementing it in the government, go to Shadow Government, where Julie and Derek and Colin will be providing articles from their team, sometimes daily, several times a week, whenever it's warranted. There's already been some great stuff. There's more great stuff coming. We're delighted you're part of the FP team. We hope you'll be back here on the ER, and who knows, maybe someday there'll be a Shadow Government podcast, because now that we've got you loosened up, we could actually get somebody to listen
here.
To it.
We're ready.
Yeah, right. We're ready.
Right.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the people tend to listen when there's the possibility that it might. So we hope you'll be back soon. Same to you who are out there listening to the ER. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe to this and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.